who thinks it's ethically wrong to eat vegetables. Eventually, I gave up my vegan ways, not for any moral reason, but because I missed meat. I missed the occasional burger. I found I had no interest in life if there was no barbecue. Prime rib is a Christmas tradition in this household. There is a reason they call it prime. It's sublime when it's done right. Neil always does it right. Steve loves the prime rib, too. He also loves the Subway meatball sandwich. It's amazing he has such a good restaurant, because his eclectic tastes go in some strange directions. But even Steve knows a perfect prime rib when he tastes one. And this prime rib is perfect. If that weren't enough, Neil also prepares pasta with a marinara sauce and hot and sweet sausage. Not enough can be said about the joys of sausage. I love it at breakfast, though not certainly on a regular basis, but when it shows up at the evening meal, I weep with joy. And with an excellent marinara sauce and an unselfish pasta, it's a rhapsody. And with prime rib, happy birthday, Jesus. And yes, I'll have another glass of red wine. Please? No one should love food like I do. I approach food much the way a Christian approaches Christ. It sure makes me happy to know it's there. The food is served and the wine flows. The dessert is excellent. I won't go into detail because by now I am swollen like a big blown-up tick. Conversations ebb and flow, cascading in crescendos over the table. We talk about what we are doing and what we're not. We laugh about how we are going to go to hell in a bucket, but that it's all going to be okay because we'll be there together. Sure, the economy is fucked, but maybe in the long run, that will be a good thing. We talk about the new drugs we're taking to control whatever conditions that age is bringing on. We talk about movies and books that we've seen and read or heard so much about that it's almost like we've already seen or read them. We sing a rousing happy birthday to Sophie. I even sing it, and I hate singing it. But I owe the kids something, even if it's just my bad singing. It's nice to be with friends. And yes, I think one more glass of wine will do quite nicely. And why not? I have nothing to do tomorrow except work on this book. I'm writing about Christmas, so fuck it. After we've finished the meal, a woman arrives. She is introduced as a single woman. She's looking, one of the guests announces. For what, I wonder? I mean, the dessert is there for the taking. She starts to turn red. Well, she has three kids, and technically, she's still married. Technically. But she's getting a divorce. Now, everybody is looking at me, as if it's up to me to say or do something. As if everybody forgets that after the divorce, when she's technically single, she'll still have three kids, and so she's really part of a foursome. She's not single. Shouldn't her friends let her relax for a bit, then revel in her newfound freedom when she finds it? Oh, no, that's not the way these things work, Lewis. You can't be alone for a minute in this culture. Lewis, you're available. Why aren't you interested in this woman you've known for exactly 10 minutes? Yes, I am single. Is there something wrong with that? Well, yes, there is, because you don't have to be. So why are you? What is wrong with you? In our culture, we don't really want single people around. I guess we make the whole social scheme messy. If we are not with someone, then somehow we are creating chaos in the universe. We raise too many questions, I guess. How come we haven't chosen to pair up? It throws things out of balance. Noah brought pairs of animals onto the ark. He didn't bring on any animal without a mate. There was a reason for that. Maybe it's hard enough to be judged for who you are, let alone to be judged for the person you've chosen to be with. I don't know. If I knew, I'd be with someone, goddammit. There is no real support in this country for people who choose to be single. Of course, one could argue that one doesn't choose to be single, that by being by themselves, they somehow are getting what they deserve. But for the purpose of my argument, let's not go there. I perform at a lot of colleges, and although there seems to be a new kind of dating, where males and females go out in packs, marriage still seems to be a high priority for many of the young people I meet. If the species and civilized behavior are to survive, it does make sense that we are pushed onto the marriage as monogamy track. As a result, though, most of us get married when we are under 30, and the standard line is that 50% of those marriages eventually end up in the shitter. Is it crazy to maybe suggest that one should learn to be alone before one learns to be in a couple? Is that really so nuts? For a country obsessed with the freedom of the individual, it doesn't seem to apply to being single. You can have all the freedom you want. Just be sure to get married, for God's sake. It took a long time for me to adjust to being alone. It may shock you to learn that I was never really comfortable with myself, and because of that, I never got fully comfortable in a relationship. Or maybe I'm just full of shit. But if given a choice, most people, it seems, would rather be in a bad relationship than no relationship at all. As uncomfortable as it may be, there's a consistency to it that we seem to crave. It fills up the time as we ponder what the fuck we are doing in a shitty relationship. God knows I have had my share of bad relationships, and God knows there were times I was the one who should take most of the blame for it being shitty. And most of the time, I did. The table has been cleared. The other guests have left, all except me. I have had a couple of espresso shots, and am clearing my head with a little cognac. It's Neil and Machiko and me, and we do what we have done over the past few years. We discuss where we want to spend next Thanksgiving. How does Argentina sound? Asks Machiko. Don't cry for me. I begin to sing. I sound great. At least I think I do. I have risen from my chair. Oh, no. I am singing and dancing. What is the matter with me? I don't even like the song. Then I look at Neil and Machiko. They are stunned and maybe a little horrified. It's time to go home. Christmas, 11:45 p.m. Another Christmas comes to an end, and our hero, obviously not quick on the uptake, learns a lesson. After the day I've had, it's amazing I can walk. It's amazing I am able to climb into the cab. It's like exercise. I roll into it. I am not so much drunk as bloated. If I were filled with helium rather than food and drink, I would make a perfect float for the Macy's Thanksgiving Day Parade. I have eaten more than any single man should at one sitting. I have eaten more than a small village should at one sitting. There is not enough Lipitor in the universe for me right now. I have been a piggy, pig, 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 piggy, piggy. In my act, I yell about idiot politicians and greedy businessmen. And yet, here I am, just as idiotic and greedy. And on Christmas Day. shame on me, for I am at this moment the fatty of the fattiest. I'm not talking girth. I am talking filled to the brim. I am oozing blubbery lipids. Years ago, when I was a young man just out of college, I would have mocked someone who had just spent the day as I had. Well, not so much the amount eaten, but the foods themselves and the pricey wine. I feel guilty about my self-indulgence, and I begin to wonder what I should have done differently today. Should I have given more to charity? Should I volunteer to be a volunteer at all of the places that need volunteers? Would that make up for all of this excess? I don't know. How do you live a good life? I just can't bring myself to do what Jesus would do, which is to give up everything and follow his path. Why can't people do that? Why can't I? And if I did, would it change anything? Since Jesus himself didn't get much done while he was alive, Christmas isn't even my holiday. And yet, I get to celebrate a better Christmas than the hundreds of millions of impoverished Christians around the world. That's not right. Of course it isn't. But right now, I am too bloated to do anything about it. Jesus Christ, the cab driver just hit a pothole and jostled me. I feel like I'm going to implode. And even though I'm feeling fat and remorseful, I know that what I did today was a great way to spend the day. I just wish I could share it with everybody. But I don't like everybody. If this guilt weren't enough, on the cab ride home, I go through all the failed relationships I have had in my life. How, where, why, when did I go wrong? What is it about commitment that leaves me uncommitted? Am I that much of a narcissist? Am I so self-absorbed that I cannot share my life with anyone? I don't know. Didn't these women who gave their love so freely to me deserve more than I gave back? Unquestionably. Do I really believe I am that much of a fucking prize? Probably, but that's no excuse. These were all women who were looking for a real marriage and a real family. And in every one of those relationships, I had the best of intentions, and I left them with what must have looked like the worst intentions. I've managed to leave a trail of tears, and yet they were all lucky to be rid of me, I think. This is it, my Israeli cab driver informs me, and a happy Hanukkah. As I ride up in the elevator, I realize that my software wasn't programmed for family life. It's barely programmed for this life, but whose is? Yet, there are women I know now I should have married, and I am haunted by regret. Their beautiful faces float across a river of memories. I mourn for the life I might have had, and the children I haven't. There are no tears, just an overwhelming sigh as I open the door to my apartment, to the place where I live. There are no children who are in desperate need of the attention I can't give them. Daddy, daddy, daddy! They would wail, and a wife crying out, where the fuck have you been? You said you'd be home by 9. The kids are making me crazy. You make me insane. I hope you had a goddamn good time. There is nothing but the sweet sound of silence. I am alone. And to be honest, I am happy. Once again, my friends have given to me more joy than they could ever imagine. I have shared their lives, and they are blessed for having them. And I am blessed for not. Every year, they share with me the road I didn't take. Every year, it reminds me that I just couldn't do it. As much as I know I have missed in my life, I fear I might have missed more. It's why I write. If I'm not going to be a father of a child, then I'd like to leave some messages behind to those who roll on through life behind me. It's like putting a message in a bottle and tossing it in the ocean that is time. If I'm not going to have a child, I'd like to think of even this silly book as my legacy. I realize I am married to my career. I am married to what I do. I am married to who I am. Maybe if I had spent more time alone and not out searching for my soulmate, things might be different today. But they are not. Maybe if I had reached some real success when I was younger. But I did not. It's the way it is. And it's good. Very good. Oh, sure, I have regrets, but that's the nice thing about age. Regrets fade. And eventually, you die. I realize I have given myself the best Christmas gift I could. The ability to live my life on my own terms. Of course, by morning, that choice could bite me right in the ass. But for now, to be honest, I couldn't be happier. And does that ever piss me off? Merry fucking Christmas! An abnormal appendix. The chairman's USO holiday tour. In 2007, I got a phone call from a guy named David Steinberg, who was Robin Williams' manager. He said that Robin wanted to know if I would go on the USO Christmas tour with him and the chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, Admiral Mike Mullen. We would be performing at bases in Afghanistan, Iraq. As soon as I heard Afghanistan and Iraq, I stopped listening. There's a war going on there, David. I'd hate to impede any progress we are making with my humor. Lewis, you're not that funny. Are you sure they want me? Did anyone tell the USO? Yes. And they didn't flinch? Not to my knowledge. They say they'd be thrilled to have you. That David is a smoothie. He can sling the bullshit with the best of them. I didn't believe him. No shit? Yes shit. Do you want to go? Of course I want to go. I promise you won't regret it. It will change your life. It did. My mother didn't want me to go. I will declare that I am on my deathbed if I have to, she said when I told her, Lewis, what are you doing this for? I am doing what I have to do for people who shouldn't be doing what they have to do. And I meant it. This is a request that you can't say no to. These people are our military. They do the job that so few of us want to do. They are literally putting themselves and their lives on the line so that I can argue with my mother about whether it's too dangerous for me to voluntarily go to entertain them for a few days. I owed them my time and whatever else the USO thought I could give to them. These are men and women fighting a war I don't believe in. But I believe in them. Though some idiots will continue to insist that you can't be against the war and for the troops. They are wrong. It's easy. It's easy because it's logical and moral. It was one of the most extraordinary experiences of my life. When people ask me, what was it like? I compare it to a 6-day LSD trip. Every time I turned around, my mind was blown. I was living entirely in the moment, which is as exhilarating as it is exhausting. It's the kind of experience that words can't give enough meaning to. The USO had set up a tour where we would spend 1 week entertaining troops in Qatar, Kuwait, Kuwait City, Camp Virginia, Kuwait, Ali al-Salam Air Base, Iraq, Al-Takaidim Army Base, Camp Fallujah, Tikrit, Baghdad, Balad, Afghanistan, Kabul, Bagram, and Kandahar. Kyrgyzstan, Manas Air Base, Aviano, Italy, and Rota, Spain. In 1 week. I was allowed to bring one friend with me to help out. I asked Steve Danielson, an excellent documentarian and friend. I never take pictures, or when I do, they are awful. So he was going to keep a film and photo record of the trip. Also, he didn't have kids, and I just didn't want to bring someone along who had kids. As safe as it might be to be with the USO, they don't call it a war zone for the purposes of humor. We left on December 16th from Andrews Air Force Base in Alexandria, Virginia, on Air Force Two. That's the plane that is second to Air Force One. Air Force fucking Two. How good is that? It's the vice president's plane and is used by other hotshots who need it for an important reason, like transporting Admiral Mullen or, as I like to refer to him privately, the Supreme Commander. I take my seat on the plane and look over at the person sitting next to me. It's Lance Armstrong. Jesus, it's Lance fucking Armstrong. I never thought our paths would cross. Why would they? I can't believe it myself. Oddly enough, I have never qualified for the Tour de France, not even as a spectator. Facing us are Kid Rock and Robin. The first two rows do actually face each other, so the bigwigs who are usually on board can talk strategy and stock prices. Jesus Christ. Robin Williams, Kid Rock, Lance Armstrong, and Lewis Black? That lineup sounds like one of those "which one doesn't belong" questions that they give as an example because it won't be on the test because it's too easy. Those other three guys are iconic. Sitting next to them, I don't feel iconic at all. I feel laconic and a little histrionic, but I keep that to myself. Oh, I forgot the most important member on the tour, and certainly the sanest. The reigning Miss USA, Rachel Smith. She's stunning. How come I've got Lance sitting next to me and not her? He's no doubt thinking the same thing. Lance Armstrong, by the way, is exactly what you think he is. He is physically perfect. Perfect. He is a Spartan soldier come to life. Everything about him seems to be there for a reason. He looks fucking bionic, and it wouldn't have shocked me if during the flight he decided to replace an arm or leg with a new one. Sitting next to him, I realized that I was merely a rotting sack of flesh. If he's bionic, I'm gin and tonic. He's got an ego, that's for sure. But he should. It's not obnoxious. He just exudes a sense that the universe seems to revolve around him. And why shouldn't it? He's Lance fucking Armstrong. He rides his bike straight up mountains. He beat cancer. Beat it senseless. I wouldn't be surprised if he can see through walls. If I were he, my ego wouldn't fit in both Air Force One and Two. Shit, I wouldn't sit next to me. Kid Rock is the personification of the rock and roller. He wears clothes that I would look like an idiot in. He has perfect hair. He has a swagger and a style that say, fuck you if you don't get me. So either you get him or you're fucked. Once I figured that out, I got him. It took a few minutes. Unlike me, Kid was gung-ho for the wars in Afghanistan and Iraq. It was obvious I wasn't. We got into it for a little while. It didn't last long, as it dawned on both of us that we were on the same side. War or no war, I wasn't flying halfway around the world to show that I didn't care, and Kid realized that. He'd been over there 5 times already. There are entertainers who are for the war, but they don't do shit. I admired him for putting his money where his mouth is. Robin Williams is bubbling over, as he does from time to time. He's not always on, only when something touches his comic imagination. And then he's like a jackrabbit examining every inch of the terrain he surveys. Later, when I asked him something about Iraq, he gave me a clear, concise, and detailed history of the country. I mean, from its very beginnings. I've spent enough time with him to believe that his memory is not only photographic, it's 3D. He seems to know a lot about a lot. Or else he's even a better bullshitter than his manager, David. It's a night flight, with a stop in Ireland to refuel, or maybe the pilots just want a pint of Guinness. When we wake up again, we are in Qatar, which is a little bump of land along the eastern side of Saudi Arabia. That's right, we landed in the Persian Gulf. As a Jew, I realized I wasn't in Kansas anymore. Are there any Jews in Kansas? I learned that there's a U.S. Army base there. No one is supposed to know we have a base there, of course, politics being politics. But, of course, everyone does. We're there to do a live show at a non-existent base for the hundreds of American soldiers who aren't really posted on this non-existent base. You figure that out. I'd been in the air for 14 hours, so I felt like I'd been hanging upside down that long. It didn't matter how I felt. It was showtime. We had to hit the stage at 10 a.m. local time. I have never been funny at 10 a.m. Never. I can't even laugh until mid-afternoon. It's not easy to be funny at 10 a.m., but if these men and women are willing to fight for me at any hour of the day or night, then I can at least pretend to be funny at 10 a.m. I give the show my best shot, so to speak. By noon, I am already overwhelmed, and we've only just begun the tour. The audience is a sea of khaki, from young to old, and by old, I mean in their late 40s, early 50s, men and women of every race, creed, and color. There's even a few elves, and a couple of Santas. After the show, we eat lunch with the troops. We ask about their lives and where they're from. And we talk about our hometowns. Even though my memory of the trip is a jumble, it's impossible to keep everything straight. I do remember that these kids humbled me deeply. They are so happy to have a little bit of the good old USA around them for a little while during Christmas. After lunch, we immediately leave Qatar and head to Kuwait. Here's what I learned about Kuwait. Women aren't allowed to drive a car in Saudi Arabia, so the Saudis bring their wives to Kuwait so they can learn. Who knew? Who cares, you ask? Well, a few hundred thousand Saudi women who can drive, that's who. 4 hours later, and we are back on stage. By now, I am jet-lagged to the tits. I've been given no instructions on what to say, just a few hints about toning down the political humor, but I knew that already. You don't tell the troops that their commander-in-chief is a jack-off and a buffoon. Particularly not in the middle of a war when you're just a few hundred miles from the enemy. I can do my bits on Republicans and Democrats, and I do. I do my bits on Christmas and Hanukkah. Our show starts to take shape. The order is Rachel, Lance, Lewis, Robin, and Kid. They love Rachel, Lance, Robin, and Kid. I'm not sure what they think of me. I know they like my foul mouth and my talent for inserting the word fuck in unlikely places. We spend the night in a Radisson in Kuwait City. Who knew there was a Radisson in Kuwait? Even weirder, there is actually a Mexican restaurant nearby. You can get Mexican food in Kuwait. Small fucking world. Some of the folks go over for a meal. Me, I couldn't see eating Mexican food in Kuwait. I passed out just thinking about it. We do two more shows the next day in Kuwait, and when we're done, we fly into Iraq and do a third show. It's about this time I come to the realization that I could never have done vaudeville. Traveling from place to place, theater to theater, one after the other, it all becomes a blur of images, like one of those experimental films they show on a wall in an art museum. My memory, a poor thing at best, can only hold on to so many fragments of this USO tour. It feels like the afterburn of an LSD trip, but there are moments from this time that I do remember. Sweet Home Alabama is one. I was never a big fan of this tune. I think it has a kind of a redneck tang to its lyrics. There's a great sense of longing in this song, but it's a longing for a time that has passed, and as far as I'm concerned, it's just as well. But it's also a longing for a place, too, and that's what gives the song its grounding. Kid Rock plays it as his closer. When he sings it, it is transformative. He knows how to cut right through the bullshit that mires down the song with nonsense and hooey and goes straight to the gut and bone. Listening to Kid's rendition of it, the troops are no longer knee-deep in the shitstorm that is this war in Iraq. They are singing. Their faces are aglow with smiles. It's the rapture of rock and roll. Kid Rock has thrown a magic carpet out to them and whisk them home. Every time he plays that song, I cry. The roar that follows when he finishes sends a rush through my body. That roar is the sound of souls being freed from this earthly madness. It's the sound of a real Christmas. There's a remarkable openness about our Supreme Commander, Admiral Mullen. Maybe it's on account of the way I stereotyped the military top brass from all those World War II movies I saw as a kid. I didn't expect Patton, but I certainly didn't expect such a nice guy with such a warm personality. And his wife, Deborah, is a doll. They could not have been more gracious or friendly to me. Me, who hates all authority. He spoke to me frankly whenever I had a question. He had a keen sense of not only the geopolitics of the world, but a sense of what would make our military stronger, and not just in a weaponry sense, but also in a human sense. During my time with him, I saw him reading a book on Iraq, and so I asked what it was, and he said it was a book he wished he had read a year ago. He said that our time in Iraq has been a lot about catching up. That's as honest an answer as anyone who knows about America's role in the Middle East could have given, and I know he certainly didn't need to share it with me. But I appreciate it more than I can say. I doubt the good admiral will like me calling him the Supreme Commander, but I do because I think it's funny. He has a tremendous affection for the men and women who serve under him. He spoke before each show we did. He was as generous in describing us, the performers, as he was talking to the troops we were performing for. I wish they could shut down Congress for a month, so he could give these idiots a workshop on leadership. Every single elected official on Capitol Hill could learn something from this thoughtful, committed gentleman. Deborah Mullen's presence on the tour is just as important. She doesn't need to be slogging through a war zone with her husband. We know that, and so does she, but she did. And I'm sure the effect on our troops, seeing her take the time to be with them and talk to them, is powerful. It shows a true concern for those in uniform that is way above and beyond the call of duty. It's about humanity. They have a really nice home on the grounds of the Naval Observatory in Washington, D.C. She could be at home, decorating the Christmas tree. But instead, she's traveling with her husband through one of the most violent places on Earth. Performing in front of an audience when I knew she was there the first time was more than a little disconcerting. But I didn't hold back. I am sure these soldiers had heard the word fuck before. It always amazed me that on Memorial Day, a few years back, a number of local TV stations throughout the country refused to show Saving Private Ryan, because when the boys hit the beach on D-Day, bombarded by artillery, some of them yelled, fuck! Who wouldn't? Do these idiots think they should be screaming sassafras? I am sure the soldiers use the word on a regular basis. I doubt, however, that Deborah ever has. By the time I finish my first set, I am positive she has heard more profanity in the last 20 minutes than she has in her entire life. I could sense her shock, but by the third show she was laughing along with the troops. I wonder if she wanders around their home now, swearing for the fun of it. Doubtful, but it's a funny thought. I think she's happy that I made the troops happy. She knew that while my mouth may be in the gutter, my heart was in the right place. On one of the flights on the tour, Deborah asked me to join her in the cockpit. Now there's a hell of a word. Who came up with that one? We were on one of those huge jumbo carrier planes that the United States keeps building, even though we have too many of them already. So I went up there to sit with her. The view was astonishing. Not just the expanse of rock and sand and desolation that is Afghanistan, but the display of all those dials, knobs, and switches the pilots have to contend with. It's even more astonishing when, on the final approach, you overhear the two Army pilots, who look to be about 9 years old, arguing over which of the base's two airstrips is the right one. Deborah and I were scared just a bit shitless. You do not want to be there for these kinds of decisions. She didn't say anything. She just put her hand on my arm and dug her fingernails into me. It made me feel better, because the searing pain gave me something to distract me from what I wanted to do, which was to start screaming like a little girl. To our growing anxiety, the pilots, as we got closer and closer to the airfield, seemed completely unconcerned. Or maybe they were just fucking with us. As we were descending, the two of them finally agreed which airstrip to land on, which was a good thing. You don't want to be remembered as the guy who shit his pants while sitting next to the wife of the chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff. We never made it to Baghdad that trip, and that pissed me off. You fly all the fuck way to Iraq, you want to see Baghdad. At this point, it was all getting very blurry. We were doing our seventh show, and it was only Wednesday. At the end of the show, we were supposed to catch a flight to Baghdad. But when it was time to go, we were told that the weather was bad for flying. It had something to do with the wind and dust storms. As a result, we were going to have to miss Baghdad, where we were to stay at Saddam's palace, or one of them at any rate. It was a bit of a blow to all of us. I wanted to see how a completely insane ruler lived. We all had personal reasons we wanted to get there. The next year, we did make it to Baghdad, and we stayed at the palace Saddam had built in honor of his daughter's wedding. It was on a man-made lake, which Saddam had stocked with fish because he liked to go fishing. There was a wall surrounding the palace that had been built to maintain privacy and so that his subjects wouldn't know that Saddam had siphoned off the water that the farmers needed for their farmland so that he could maintain his lake. For his occasional amusement and recreation, Saddam left the local farmers with arid land to till. In the build-up to the war, this is the kind of information that we might have been told. It certainly would have helped in manipulating public opinion. I guess just saying he was a meanie was enough. Oh yeah, and those weapons of mass destruction. Since we couldn't get to Baghdad the first time, we had to stay at the base that night. Usually each of us had our own room. They were nothing fancy, but compared to the troops' quarters, we were living large. It turned out that because of a lack of housing, all of the guys were going to have to stay together. Armed with this happy news, I walked into the very confined space. The whole experience brought back images of summer camp, which I hated. My mind was too fried to cope. The place felt claustrophobic, and I never feel claustrophobic. Up to that point, I had been able to take anything that had been thrown at me, but this was more than I could handle. In one small room, there were 6 bunk beds. There was barely enough room to move around. Fucking stinking bunk beds. That did it. The combination of a lack of sleep, the fatigue caused by the crazy performing schedule, and my own overloaded emotions made me snap. Severely. I had no choice, so I launched into a tirade at the poor girl who was in charge of us. "You've got to be kidding me. This is it? This is where you want us to stay tonight? There are no other rooms on the base? I'll take a tent if you've got one. You can't put us all in here. There won't be enough oxygen in this confined space to get us through the night. For God's sake, we don't even have booze to make this seem like fun. Besides, I have a deep-seated fear that these guys will try and gang-rape me, and who could blame them?" The girl went into shock and scurried off. Completely rattled, my brain was misfiring severely. Was this part of an experiment they were running on us, I wondered? Is this some kind of test to determine our psychological readiness for combat? They could have just asked, and I would have told them, "I have never been ready for combat." If it was, then they needed to lock up the bazookas, because I was ready to explode. By the time I calmed down, I looked around the room and noticed that there were only top bunks left. Fuck! I get up a lot at night. I don't sleep well, even in the best of conditions. And these definitely were not. Who knows what my shattered psyche would make me do in the middle of the night in a war zone? I could easily forget where I was and get out of bed and break a few limbs. I was a basket case. Kid Rock was nice enough to exchange bunks with me, and I was nice enough not to tease him when he started reading a magazine article about Michael Jackson. I was surprised when the girl I yelled at came back. By then, we were all in our bunks. She announced there was a couch in the TV room that I could sleep on. The ladies were all watching TV, and I could join them. Huh, well, I'm no little sissy boy. I heard myself say, "I don't leave my men." I actually said that. I don't think I've laughed harder at anything else that I have ever said. I was delirious. So was everyone else. Everyone was screaming with laughter. When she closed the door on this group of men, we immediately reverted to being 12-year-olds. Scattered farts shot across the room. The fart is man's most basic form of communication. It's the way we say all is well. How are you? Robin and I began to plumb the comic depths of our situation. The ensuing madness that occurred in this room is one of the funniest times of my life, and I can't remember any of it. Only the joy of men being so stupid, tired, and silly that we couldn't see straight. We could only laugh our tits off. By early morning, we were off and headed to God knows where. Practically every place we went was God knows where. God and the people who call it home. Humans adapt to anything. I can't. I couldn't even adapt to 8 guys in a tiny room on bunk beds. I don't adapt well to long lines, or automated operators, or being put on hold and having to listen to bad music. I am a big baby. I admit it. Meanwhile, the men and women we were entertaining are struggling to adapt to a barren terrain, ungodly temperatures, and an enemy that wants to destroy them 24/7. Oh, wait. Now I remember where we're headed. Kabul, which, it turns out, translates as God knows where. Every aircraft we get on is the loudest plane on Earth, from the jumbo troop carriers to the small ones to the helicopters. Every one of them is fucking loud, louder than when I stood in front of speakers at rock concerts. But after 3 days, something strange happens. You get used to the noise. It doesn't matter anymore. I get on the plane and pass out. I don't know how our service people do it. Every time I see something new that they have to deal with, I am more than amazed by their discipline. How do they hold it together? I'm just there to entertain, and I'm losing my mind about the accommodations. And these people have families. Yet, they have a bond as a group that seems in some ways stronger than the bond of blood. It can't just be patriotism. It's got to be that every day they are living on the edge of death, and they trust each other to keep them safe. We roll into Kabul. It is a desolate place. It is a land of muted browns and grays and of cold that chills you to the bone. The Afghans walk by the side of the road. As we drive by in our car with an army escort, I stare at their grim faces. I am only a few feet from them, but I might as well be a million miles away. We hear later that there was a suspicious car that had to be dealt with on our route. We don't get much more information than that. There is security for us everywhere. The soldiers who watch over us are incredible, not just as protectors, but as people. They go 24/7. They're always smiling. They seem to have a real love for what they do. I feel completely safe. Of course, if they can't protect the Supreme Commander, then we are royally fucked. We never see the enemy. If we do, we don't know it. At least I don't. And I'm paying attention. While I'm in the Middle East, there's an ABC news crew reporting on the war. Somebody asked to interview me about my experiences there. I agree. During the interview, the reporter asks me to describe my feelings. I try, but I can't. Instead, I cry. I hardly ever cry. It's snowing in Kabul, and night has fallen. We are late for the show. We are always late. The schedule is tight. It would be a miracle if we ever kept to it. A few hundred troops have stood out in the cold and snow awaiting our arrival. I don't know of any show I would wait for under these conditions, even when I was a kid. The outdoor stage is small and wooden. There's a sad-looking Christmas tree without enough ornaments on it. It's still snowing, but once again, it's showtime. We are surrounded by a roar pouring out of hundreds of expectant faces. The show was great, and Robin and Kid end with an improv blues number about being in the army and in Afghanistan. It destroys. To call the night magical doesn't do it justice. It kept snowing. The audience was oblivious. Once again, they were home. I was there, though. And I was freezing my nuts off. We take photos with the troops after every show. Robin and Kid give as much offstage as they do when they are on stage. They surround Lance Armstrong. A few of the more intelligent guys gravitate toward Rachel. It's not like it was when the army was all male. There are women everywhere. Rachel is beautiful, but in the world of today's army, she is not a complete novelty. I am sure during World War II, Korea, and Vietnam, the troops flocked to the actresses and models, while Bob Hope practiced his golf swing and cracked jokes. Even though we traveled thousands of miles, from one end of a war zone to the other, we don't see the dead. But every so often, you saw a soldier who seemed lost, or like he just couldn't take it anymore, whatever it was. Their stare is unsettling. Even when they're standing still, they seem to vibrate. I wonder if this is a war that is worth the cost of taking a man and making him hollow. The most surreal moment of my entire time as a USO entertainer comes when we are in a chopper. I love saying chopper. It sounds so much better than helicopter, flying us to another show. I've never trusted this mode of transportation to begin with, but to make it worse, the back of this one is open, and a soldier sits at the opening with a mounted gun. I look out beyond him. There's nothing for miles. I don't have enough energy to imagine or fear that he might need to use that weapon to pick off an enemy. The gunner beckons Kid to join him. Kid gets up and walks toward the opening. We are flying over some areas where there are practice targets, and so Kid sits down and lets it rip. Then Lance does the same. The soldier beckons to me. Are you fucking kidding me? Walk across a chopper toward a wide open space that is just beckoning for a body to fly out of it? No, thank you. I didn't come to Iraq to watch Lance Armstrong, million-time Tour de France winner, or Kid Rock, guitar hero and rock star, fly out the back of a chopper. I also didn't want to make the nightly news back home and try to explain to a talking head why I didn't stop them or what I felt like as I watched them hurtle toward Earth. Then we'd have to land and peel them off the desert. Fortunately, there was no drama. Despite my fears, it was just Lance Armstrong and Kid Rock firing off a few rounds of ammo into the desert below. The whole thing was nuts. Too crazy for words. I had to remind myself, we are at war, and those words are crazy enough. A female soldier, I believe she was a sergeant, explains to me that the problem is going to be when these young troops go home. In Iraq, they have no booze or sex. They have no outlets. They are going through hell. They will arrive home ticking time bombs, the men and the women. During both tours, I meet a lot of National Guardsmen. As my friend, the comedian Kathleen Madigan, says, this isn't the way it was presented to those guys at the recruiting office. I doubt if a tour of duty in Iraq or Afghanistan was played up in the brochures. I spent some time talking to an Army colonel. He's in the Oregon National Guard. He was a gym teacher and a coach in the school system there. He's already been here for one tour of duty, then he returned home. He started teaching again, and now the Guard has brought him back. Maybe in World War II, you ask school teachers to go to war. But in this war? Really? Is it all hands on deck for this one? For Christ's sake, the guy is a teacher. He teaches. Shouldn't that exempt him? When they are forcing us to take teachers out of the classrooms, haven't the terrorists won? I doubt the colonel would agree with me. He knows his men need him as much as his students do, if not more. I don't agree, but I've come to understand that this is the way a soldier thinks. He has to think that way. He has to when he is here. I can't remember all of the hundreds of stories that the troops shared with me. I wish I could. Every one of them should be told. There's one story I heard that has truly stayed with me. A woman soldier in her late 40s and I began talking very early one morning as she was policing the area. She had a friend, another female soldier, whose husband, another soldier, was back in the United States with their daughter. He had been called up and was going to have to ship out to Afghanistan. This will leave their daughter without a parent at home. Apparently, having a child at home with at least one parent isn't vital to the welfare of the country. so the woman I was speaking to told her friend that she was set to go home. Her tour was over, but that she would stay on so that her friend could go home in her place. Her friend still had 5 months left on her tour. She convinced the base commander to let them change places. Talk about the gift of the Magi. To put oneself in harm's way for a friend? The woman's generosity took my breath away. Now that, my friends, is a Christmas gift. This is Lewis Black. We hope that you've enjoyed this production of I'm Dreaming of a Black Christmas. This program was executive produced by Patty Peruse and produced and directed by John McElroy. I'm Dreaming of a Black Christmas is a production of Penguin Audio, a member of Penguin Group USA Incorporated. Copyright 2010. All rights reserved. The book, I'm Dreaming of a Black Christmas, is available wherever Riverhead books are sold.
Audible hopes you have enjoyed this program.